Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Donia Ziai. On today's program, we're dissecting the views and politics of the man who's widely believed to be the next leader of the Liberal Party, Mark Carney. He's billed himself as a political outsider, but he's also positioning himself as a voice of calm, expertise, and pragmatism. Canada's media have given him some other fun titles too, a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, an intellectual with a populist touch, the architect of a brave new world taking inspiration from Marx, Engels, and Lenin. That last one was naturally from the National Post. What his real bio shows is that he's an elite banker who started at Goldman Sachs before serving as the governor of the Bank of Canada and then the Bank of England, and later chairing the giant asset management firm, Brookfield. Right now, Mark Carney is considered to be the front runner by a long shot for the leadership of the Liberal Party, way ahead of his biggest rival in the race, Chrystia Freeland. He's raised the most funds, and he's helping the Liberals surge in popularity too. A new poll this week showed that Carney, as the hypothetical leader of the party, would bring the Liberals neck and neck with the Conservatives in the next election. Today on the podcast, we're taking a longer view of Carney's trajectory in politics with journalist David Mosgrop, who has just written a piece about this for The Breach. You can find that online at breachmedia.ca. David, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Carney really loves to claim this outsider status, as I mentioned, you know, as someone who's never run for politics. He joked about it on the Jon Stewart show. It's how he launched his campaign. He even took a jab at Justin Trudeau recently when he did an interview on CBC with Rosemary Barton. You know, when he was asked, how are you different from Trudeau? He said, well, we're very different people. I was born in the Northwest Territories. He was born in Rideau Hall. So what exactly has he been outside of? I mean, isn't he exactly the kind of liberal elite that people like Poilievre have built their entire brand around?
Yeah, I think he is. And elites will sometimes do this thing where they'll say, well, I come from humble beginnings. You know, Mark Carney, I was born in the Northwest Territories. I grew up in Edmonton. I played hockey. I was a goalie. As if that unmakes him a Goldman Sachs banker, a two-time central banker, chair of Brookfield Asset Management, UN envoy for climate and Liberal Party economic advisor. It's as, you know, as if your status as an elite is class-based and hereditary like it would have been a few centuries ago instead of a status you can acquire. So he's trying to do this thing of, I'm just a normal everyday guy. And then we'll turn around and say, oh, by the way, I'm an elite. You know, he was on a podcast with Alistair Campbell and Anthony Scaramucci. And he says, you know, they're going to call me an elite and a globalist. And that's what we need. And that's what I am. That's basically what he said. And so he tries to have it both ways.
Totally. It's like he's an outsider, but also the right kind of insider.
Right. That's it, right? I'm an outsider, which is defined implicitly and narrowly as not having been a part of electoral politics on the governing side or any side, but an insider insofar as he knows how to work the room and he knows all the world leaders and he knows how the institutions of the globe work and how, you know, mass global finance works. And that's how you try to say, well, I'm not your everyday guy and politician, but I, of course, do know how the world works and I've been in all these rooms with all these elites. And it seems to be, to my astonishment, working. And I do confess to be a little bit surprised, because ahead of this, I thought, I cannot think of a man less fit to meet the moment of populist anger, of anti-establishment fervor, than Mark Carney. And he, for at least the moment, seems to be doing quite well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his history and his track record to see how it stacks up against these claims. I want to start with his time at the Bank of Canada. You know, Canada gets a lot of rep for evading the worst of the Great Recession in 2008, supposedly because of, you know, his hand at the tiller. Can you talk a little bit about what actually happened during his time as governor?
Well, I mean, I think it's complicated because it's both true that during Carney's time at the Bank of Canada, he was in favor of injecting liquidity into the market to prevent a crash, and that was necessary. Mm-hmm. And that subsequently, because of that liquidity and because of the policy of cheap money that emerged subsequently, we have a legacy of dodgy investments, a housing crisis, extreme household debt, and wealth inequality, which was driven by 15 or so years of cheap money. So at once he seemed to make, quote unquote, the correct decision, but at the same time upheld and supports a system in which the correct decision in the moment, which is to avert a catastrophe, leads to long-term problems and underwrites the very system that produces subsequent crises in the future, which you need to make the quote unquote correct decision. And so how do you score that?
Well, but it is true that when his, you know, legacy during that time is talked about, you don't often hear about the big bank bailout. I mean, the Canadian banks got, just from the Bank of Canada, more than $40 billion injected. Some of them got more than the total value of their company.
Yeah, this was like the same thing we heard in the United States, that the banks were effectively too big to fail. Mm-hmm. And that is true. And that is also an indictment of a system in which you as a banking institution can make billions of dollars off of customers, run an oligarchical structure in which you dominate investments and dominate savings and dominate mortgages. And when things go bad, say, okay, well, we need public money or else the whole house of cards is going to fall and get it. And then turn around a few years later and go back to exploiting the very people who just bailed you out.
And, you know, he's made a big reputation too as a climate banker. You know, he's a big believer in ethical green investments. You mentioned he was a UN Special Envoy for Climate Change. Talk a little bit about his track record there as far as this idea of green investment goes.
This is such an interesting question because I do think it gets to the heart of Mark Carney as better than the worst options, but nowhere near as good as he pretends to be or his supporters make him out to be. And let's take a couple of examples. Let's do the Glasgow GFANZ, the Glasgow financial net zero thing he launched a few years ago.
The Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero.
Right. First of all, the name itself should have been disqualifying because it's such a silly name. But we'll set aside the aesthetics of it for a moment and say, okay, what did it actually do? Is this idea that, look, we can bring together all these massive financial institutions, by the way, the ones who fund oil and gas and other projects that have got us into the climate crisis. We'll bring them all in. And we'll say they're going to lead us on the way to net zero through the power of capital. And this echoes what he talks about in his book, Values, which is basically we can persuade companies to do right, to do good, and because it's not just the right thing to do, but it's also in their best interest. And so he puts this thesis to the test. And then the going gets a little bit tough, and the banks are like, okay, well, we're out. Mm-hmm. This thing is voluntary. It puts constraints on us. We don't like constraints. When push comes to shove, we are out. We're all happy to talk about climate and net zero and responsible mutual funds and stocks and whatever. But if it's actually onerous or costly, we're gonna pull out, which is exactly what they did, especially in light of Trump. Especially the U.S. banks were like, okay, we're out, which is proof positive that trying to push the market, especially the financial market and institutions, by moral suasion just doesn't work because they exist to do one thing, which is to accumulate capital, to produce a return for investors. So, of course, that fell apart. Let's take a second example. Until recently, Carney chairs Brookfield Asset Management, massive asset management firm. And as Jason Mogis, a campaigner in climate and other things, tells me, this organization is four times more invested in dirty energy than clean energy, and it's expanding its dirty energy holdings. So it was like, if you're talking about putting your money where your mouth is and you look to Carney and the institution he's associated with, well, you know what? They're leveraged, they're up to the hilt in oil and gas, and they're not leading the charge that people think they're leading.
Before we get into the policy proposals he has on the table now, is there anything else from his past and his track record that stands out to you?
I think it's worth saying that the man he's plainly an expert. He plainly he's not a fool. And I try to take him at face value when he says he believes in the power of the market. Businesses are the primary driver of value and values, mm-hmm. of wealth creation and so on and so forth. Like, he truly does believe that the market can solve the problems that the market has created, that he can have a kinder and gentler capitalism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think he believes that. And if you start from that premise, then his politics and his track record makes sense. Now, you and I might look at him and say, these things are inconsistent. He embodies all these contradictions of liberalism, all these contradictions of capitalism. And I think he's the Lord of the Rings meme, or what's his face is like staring at the rings. Like, I can compromise with this, you know, like I can make this work. Or I like to think of it as the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where at the end of the film, Elsa and later Indy are reaching for the cup of Christ, which is hanging, dangling, sitting on this ledge and about to fall into an abyss, and are just reaching for it because it's just outside their grasp and they feel like they can grasp it and they can have it all. I think Mark Carney believes that he can have it all. He's reaching for that cup of Christ, and he just can't let it go.
I mean, either he believes it and, to paraphrase others, either he believes it and he's a fool, or he doesn't and he thinks we're the fools.
Yeah, I think he believes it. I do. I mean, I think he's in this environment in which he has spent all of his time in these boardrooms. He's spent all this time talking to people who think this way and who look and say, look at all these great things that capitalism has generated. And yeah, it's had some problems, but, you know, who doesn't have some problems? And what's the alternative? And so let's talk about how we can, you know, shave off the rougher edges of this system, which, by the way, is as old as Bismarck, right? Like this idea that you can take this system and compromise with it or shape it or refine it in order to perpetuate it because it's fundamentally good, even though it has some problems, is old, right? I mean, this is how we get the welfare state in some senses, is that, well, we got to do something to keep this thing going or else we're going to get the communists, we're going to get the socialists. And I think that Carney is a continuation of that. And I do think he believes it truly, madly, and deeply. I just don't think he's right about it.
Well, let's talk about what he's proposing to do as prime minister. You know, he launched this campaign last month after turning down multiple offers from Trudeau to join his government. And since then, he has he's pitched several policies that, to me at least, suggest that he wants to move the Liberal Party further to the right. And I want to go through some of these policies with you, and I'll start with the carbon tax. So Carney has now also joined the bandwagon in wanting to axe this tax. What's he proposing in its place?
Yeah, I think this is also a complicated and interesting one, because there's lots of critiques of individual or consumer carbon pricing that say, well, it was a fool's errand to put it on, to put this burden on consumers, because one, it hits vulnerable people. I mean, that's a little bit complicated because when you have a rebate.
Well, that's it. Canadians were receiving, for the most part, they were receiving back more than they were paying.
Yeah,
ultimately.
Exactly. And yet it's a hard sell because it's very easy to torque that to make it sound like people aren't getting more money than they're putting in, right? And so the carbon tax consensus is dead, and Carney doesn't want anything to do with it, nor does anyone else at this point. And his thing is, we're going to keep the industrial emitters charges, and which, by the way, are let's say bearable for the market. They're not particularly onerous. We're going to introduce green incentives for consumers. So it's really, you know, if we're doing carrot stick on the consumer side, this is the carrot. And so people can buy a greener washer and get more money, or whatever it might be, and get more money back. So, you know, you'll be persuaded to do it that way. And he's talking about a carbon border adjustment, which is effectively, as it happens, a tariff. As we talk about tariffs and loathe tariffs, it's basically saying, well, I'm going to introduce a border adjustment so that if you're bringing in products from a country that doesn't have higher carbon standards and they're effectively subsidizing that by not paying the full price of carbon, we're going to adjust prices at the border to make things more competitive for companies that are doing the right thing. I mean, again, this is the kind of like light hand of the state to guide corporations to do the right thing, to incentivize them to do the right thing. It's just not enough. It's just nowhere near enough. It's still, and it continues to exist within the paradigm that has produced the crisis in the first place. Like, is this really a time for tepid liberal centrism?
Yeah. And I do agree with your earlier point about the carbon tax being this kind of half measure that didn't really show people like how it was materially improving their lives. And that, you know, obviously we need much more ambitious climate policies. Yet it feels like, you know, Carney giving up this tax is just like a perfect gift to the right.
One of the failures of the center and the left in recent years, and it's par for the course for the center, but it's particularly disappointing for the left, such as it is in this country, is operating within the frame of the right. It's like showing up to a duel, and the one guy says to the other, I'm really good with pistols, you're really good with swords, how about we do pistols? And the guy says, okay, yeah, pistols sounds good. Why don't you put one right between my eyes? And then the other guy proceeds to do exactly that. And, you know, this is it, is we've just accepted the right frame. And, you know, Trudeau himself did this. And this is, you know, the Trudeau government brings in the consumer price on carbon, defends it, goes to the mat for it for a period of time. And then when the going gets tough, they're like, well, okay, we're going to start talking about carve outs. We're going to remove it from home heating for oil. And we're going to, yeah, okay. We're, you know, because people are having a hard time. It starts to undermine your argument pretty fast. And then it's a race to the bottom in what you cannot do to fight climate change.
So back to Carney's campaign, what is our green banker's position on pipelines?
Pipe, baby, pipe, I guess, is the, I regretted that as soon as I said it. This is a growing position of convenience, which is Donald Trump comes in, threatens tariffs, threatens Canadian sovereignty, precipitates a wave of patriotic fervor and nationalism, which incidentally, I actually think is in some ways very good and potentially very useful for the left if they can sort out how to mobilize it. But then, you know, people say, well, my God, we need security. We need energy security. We can't rely on piping everything north-south. We can't rely on sending everything to Oklahoma, down to Texas, whatever. We need to do this north-south, or we need to do this east-west. And so we need pipelines. You know, then we start talking about reviving energy east. And so Carney's talking about, you know, using emergency federal powers to push through infrastructure projects, which again, shorthand is pipelines. Now, he says something different in Quebec, where that's much less popular, although that might actually even be changing a little bit. But, you know, it's really, Quebec didn't want Energy East. They're very particular about their sovereignty over energy and other projects. And so Carney sends a different message to Quebec, as all politicians always do, by the way. Worst kept secret in Canadian politics is that there's the Quebec campaign and then the rest of Canada campaign, but Carney's doing that. But he's talking about pipelines, but so is everybody. So is the federal energy minister, Jonathan Wilkinson, was talking about this. You know, the Liberals can buy a pipeline, can oppose other pipeline projects, and can create tougher standards for these infrastructure projects, and then the next day say, well, actually, maybe we need an east-west pipeline after all. And people are like, well, I guess. And because it's sort of, it meets that moment where people are concerned about national sovereignty and about energy security.
What about Carney on economic policy? You know, he loves to say that we need to spend less and invest more. What does that mean?
Who knows? The way he's put it is that he's going to run a deficit for investments, but attempt to balance the books on operational expenses. Now, your guess is as good as mine about what that looks like in practice when the rubber hits the road. To me, that sounds like we're going to cut something. And what's that something? Well, if you listen to Carney in Quebec, it's not programs, it's not entitlements, but you listen to the rest of Canada and you think, actually, maybe it is programs and entitlements. And my read of it, because he's talking about using public money to, quote unquote, you know, spur growth, because a rising tide lifts all ships. This is the argument, which, by the way, is trickle-down economics. Just, you know, this is the equivalent of trickle-down economics. Like, well, tax cuts will find their way back. It's the same thing as, well, if we spend all this public money on the private sector, we're going to get them to build more houses and your house is going to be cheaper, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that seems to be the play. So it sounds to me like he's going to spend a lot of money on a giveaway to the private sector to get more AI, to get more infrastructure projects built, to get more houses built, none of which the public will own, by the way, or control. And at the same time, is going to cut operational spending, quote unquote, which I'm sure will involve the public service getting slashed, which is another Poilievre frame, and will probably involve some program cutting, which is yet again a Poilievre frame, although Carney says he's going to keep certain things like the Canada Child Benefit, which I think and hope will become sacred and untouchable. Because incidentally, as a quick aside, I think when we look at the Trudeau years, the Trudeau ministry, 10, 20 years out, any careful observer, any historian, any economist is going to look at the Canada Child Benefit as the marquee policy of this government, for which it deserves genuine praise. And so Carney won't touch something like that. But I start to look around like, okay, that one, that's grown to adulthood. But what about pharmacare? What about dental care? What about daycare? I started looking at those and thinking like, well, you know, this is where we might start hearing the word efficiencies.
Yeah, yeah. The Liberals were already, you know, brandishing about this term for the pharmacare program. You know, they were calling it a pilot project, which was already worrisome enough. And who knows, with Carney at the helm, trying to, you know, cut operational spending, what that will mean. But on top of all that, he's also cutting taxes.
Well, yeah, you got to cut taxes. I mean, we'll see specifically, you know, who gets, what bracket gets cut and into how much. But this is more liberal orthodoxy. You know, the 2015 Trudeau campaign was focused on the middle class and those working hard to join it, right? And it was that, look, we're going to cut for middle class earners, and that's going to be good because they're having a hard time. All right, fair enough, I guess. But it's true that people are having a hard time making ends meet, especially including the middle class, because everything's very expensive. Housing is expensive. Groceries are expensive. Cars are expensive. All the things that we've come to need because we don't build better cities. So we're going to get some cuts, which, of course, you have to pay for, right? So you've got to then find some money somewhere else, because you're giving all the money you have to private industry to, quote unquote, spur investment. But you want to run a balanced budget in the long term, and at least a balanced budget on operational expenses in the short term. Oh, and by the way, you got to spend free up money for the military. So
can't forget that. He has promised to have Canada reach the NATO benchmark of spending 2% of its GDP on military spending by 2030, which is 5 years from now. So he wants to spend billions more on the military while he's cutting taxes. And by the way, he's not just cutting taxes for the middle class. He's also scrapping the capital gains tax increase.
Yeah, this is another one where the Liberals were all for it, including Chrystia Freeland, who was all for it as finance minister up until December, when she was still in favor of it, speaking in favor of it, and then quits the cabinet, runs for leader herself, and is now opposed to it, and Carney's opposed to it too. And this was what gets me is that the capital gains increase was such a modest ask. It was really about saying, we're going to increase the inclusion rate, not even the percentage of the tax itself, just the inclusion rate, and everybody lost it. And all of a sudden, it was class war. Just to ask a teeny tiny bit more. And much like the carbon tax, as soon as there was a kind of revolt from capital and from business journalists in the Financial Post or the National Post or whatever, they ran away from it. The liberals started hemming and hawing. They started talking about amendments well before Carney or Freeland abandoned it. And then, of course, Carney and Freeland come in and they abandon it. They're out. And so, again, all this money disappears. This money that would have been public coffers is gone at the same time that Carney is spending it. And the point you raise is utterly critical. He's talking about cuts. He's talking about spending more. The cuts he's talking about are to things that we share. The spending are to things that are going to enrich private industry. I mean, look whose balance sheet at the end of the day ends up better off with these cuts and with these and with this spending. And that's how you know who's at the trough and who's being served and who's not.
Yeah. So to recap his campaign slogans: more military spending, more pipelines, more tax cuts, less spending. Plus, he's thrown in some attacks on the left for good measure, saying they like to spend as the solution to every problem. I don't know. It's all sounding pretty familiar to me. Even Polyev was boasting recently that Carney is plagiarizing his campaign. What do you make of this the strategy from Carney to shift the liberals more and more to the right?
Well, I mean, I think it's a regression to the liberal mean. We on the left have criticized Trudeau quite rightly, and I think quite fairly for 10 years. When you look at Trudeau kind of top down or historical context, he actually is to the left of most liberal leaders, and then by definition of most prime ministers in the history of this country. That's not to say he's left. That's not to say he's a socialist, right? Or a communist, as he's been called. I mean, he's none of these things. It's so stupid.
He's at the very least good at co-opting and watering down the demands on the left.
Oh, absolutely he is. And the NDP has played into that for itself, right? I mean, the NDP who genuinely got some good things from its support of the government, the anti-scab law, for instance, some semblance of a bigger welfare state with pharmacare and so on and so forth, but a much less ambitious program than we might have hoped for. Fine. And again, like to put things in context and in a comparative evaluation, say Trudeau is better than his predecessors. He's better than Carney. He's not a socialist. He's very much a liberal and a capitalist. But now we can't even have that teeny tiny bit of a nice thing. We have to go lurch to the right. And I actually think Carney looks a lot like Chrétien and Martin. You know, I think Polyev likes to compare him to himself and say, well, he's ripping off our platform. But I think that reflects the fact that in this country, there's an extremely narrow, acceptable ideological bandwidth that is fundamentally liberal, it's fundamentally class capitalist, and insofar as there's any care about the welfare state, it's Bismarckian, which is to say that, you know, you get the welfare state in Bismarckian Prussia because there's a concern that if you don't do it, the system's going to fall apart and the real left is going to win. And so you start introducing this welfare state. And that's how we operate here. And I look at Carney and say, it looks a lot like he's going back to the Chrétien Martin playbook of the 90s. Very slow moving on anything, very quote unquote pragmatic, very much intent on serving capital markets and in starving social programming and within the narrow ideological bandwidth of acceptable politics in this country. And so I actually think Carney is a regression to the liberal mean more than anything else.
And he's popular, at least so far.
I don't even know what to say. He is popular. I mean, he's popular in the sense that he's out fundraising and out polling Chrystia Freeland.
Sure.
Which is damning with faint praise if there ever was, right? And Carina Gould and Frank Bayless and Ruby Dalla. Okay, fine. So he's leading them. He's got a lot of support from liberal cabinet members, which is a stunning rebuke of Chrystia Freeland, who sat across from these folks for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he's enjoying a kind of bump or tightening in the polls. And that one I'm reserving judgment on ultimately for a period of time, because maybe that's real. And maybe it's because people like Mark Carney, but maybe it's also in part or in whole something else. Like maybe there's an exogenous factor here, like Pierre Poilievre is about as likable as a double lung infection. And so if you present someone else, someone's like, oh, okay, well, I'll take the single lung infection with apologies to the Pope. And so, you know, maybe that's what that is. Maybe it's the kind of bounce we see sometimes when an unpopular leader goes and is replaced. We saw this with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and we all know how that went. It went to autocratic U.S. Quote-unquote democracy, the rise of fascism in the U.S. Go back to 1992, 1993, when Brian Mulroney, wildly unpopular, quits, and Kim Campbell becomes the prime minister and leader of the PC party, and has a pretty significant bounce in the polls, including up into and through the election, and it ends up down to 2 seats. Her party decimated, the Conservatives decimated, until the early to mid 2000s. So it could, that Carney bump could be temporary. So I don't want to give him too much credit, but for the moment, he's pretty popular, and it's at least conceivable that the Liberals could make a comeback under him that they wouldn't have been able to make under Trudeau, or even think of under Trudeau.
Yeah, but and what about the tariff threats? How have those played into his popularity, do you think? I think both in terms of the effect that they've had in maybe dropping support for Poilievre, but also just emboldening people like him to talk about their more rightward policy ideas.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating because there's some polling data that suggests that voters preferred Poilievre to Trudeau on dealing with Trump, but prefer Carney to Poilievre.
Mm.
And I actually think that, again, part of it is that people don't actually like Poilievre. I mean, this is, don't mistake support for the Conservatives as support for Poilievre, which I think genuinely people don't like him because he's so utterly unlikable. And Carney is kind of affable. He's kind of avuncular, right? He gets a kind of pass on that. And I actually think this is an extraordinarily important point about him that we need to think about and to dissect and sit with, which is that he does have this sense of calming, steady hand on the tiller. He looks and talks like a prime minister. He's kind of dignified. He's older. He's got kind of grayish hair. He speaks like he knows what he's doing with a certain confidence, but it's not, you know, petulant. And he's constructed as a prime minister. And that construction, this idea in our heads, this almost platonic idea of what a prime minister is and looks like, Carney is straight out of central casting. And you can go in the social psychology and political psychology research on this, and that where they had people go look at photos of candidates, and they asked the people, which one looks more like a governor or a congressman or whatever? And that would predict the winner in a majority of cases, that person who looked the part. Of course, that's a construction that is racist, sexist, ageist, ableist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it is the common sense construction that we have and that we perpetuate. And Carney fits the bill. So I actually think there's a lot of that going on too, which says nothing about whether or not he has the capacity or not, but says everything about our popular construction of leadership and competence.
Yeah. Is he the kind of politician we need right now to respond to all the crises of our time? You know, we're talking about extreme inequality, cost of living crisis, planetary crisis, and then on top of that, a right-wing agenda that's like seizing on all the outrage that's coming out of all of this. Are we just going to end up with Poilievreism without Poilievre if we get Mark Carney?
Well, I think so. I think we're going to, I think we're going to end up with Chrétien Martin, which, you know, is basically Poilievreism to a large extent. And I look at the the moment of crisis in which we're in. And I actually kind of feel ripped off, because I think if you go back and look at 20th century history and moments of crisis, you see Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression and the Second World War, who, again, for all his faults, remade the welfare state and U.S. government. You see Clement Attlee in the United Kingdom at the end of the Second World War, who came in and pursued a remaking of Great Britain. And then we are in a crisis that is in many ways akin to those past crises, not just the climate crisis, although that's premier, but also the crisis of the rise of autocracy and fascism and the decline of even deeply flawed liberal democracy. And like, well, what do we got now? People are like, well, we're going to futz around at the edges and try to persuade companies to be good. And I think we'll ultimately get Carney or someone like Carney, certainly those sorts of policies, until someday somebody sees that there's a critical juncture to be seized, that there's a real moment of populist anger that can be mobilized through grassroots, participatory, deep democracy and socialism, as it happens, to remake the country. But I look around and think, well, I don't know who that's going to be. But it's certainly not going to be Mark Carney.
Well, David, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, if you like what you've heard on The Breach Show, please subscribe to the podcast. And if you support our work, please become a sustaining member to help us produce more journalism for transformation. You can do that by going to breachmedia.ca/support. Thanks for listening.